Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Today's guest is a little bit different from usual guests. Today's guest is English professional footballer Kieran Gibbs, who currently plays for Inter Miami FC, and most of you might know him from his time at Arsenal Football Club and West Bromwich Albion, as well as the England national team. Kieran is a Bitcoiner, and I am a big football fan. So this is something that I've really looked forward to. Because I'm really looking forward to talking to somebody who knows a lot about football and how Bitcoin has affected him and how Bitcoin has affected his life, what it has meant to him as an athlete. And it's something that I'm really looking forward to. So, Kieran, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, not a problem. I mean, to be honest, it's an honor, man. I was stoked when you messaged me to to come on. I've been following you for so long, Saifi, so...
Well, it's a real honor to have you here, Ben. I've followed you for much longer than you followed me, I'm sure. I remember you from when you made your debut for Arsenal. I follow football very closely, and I remember you very well. I watched many, many games for you over the years. I'm not an Arsenal fan, as you know. I'm a Liverpool fan. I've enjoyed watching you. Mostly, I haven't actually. I was looking at your record against Liverpool, and you have an incredibly good record against Liverpool. I don't know if you probably remember, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say it's actually one of my highlights. That's something that I'm quite proud of. My record at Anfield, especially, even for West Brom when I signed at West Brom, we played there in the FA Cup. We won actually. I'm pretty sure we won.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and then obviously all of the Premier League games for Arsenal and West Brom, I've always managed to, I was probably a bit of a bogey for them at Anfield over the
year. I was looking for things to tease you with, but unfortunately, don't have much to go with. You weren't there for the 5-1. I think you were on the bench for the time when Liverpool won 5-1 at.
That's right.
Arsenal. Yeah, you were on the bench, so you got away.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my first game at Anfield. It was 4-4. When Andre Arshavin scored,
I remember that one.
Goals. So
that was basically the game that ended Liverpool's title challenge in 2009.
Yeah,
if they'd won that game, we were likely going to be champions, and we didn't.
Yeah,
I remember that game. Yeah, I mean, I followed Wenger, Arsene Wenger, very, very closely for a lot of time, and I admire the man a lot. I think he is an incredible manager, one of the top managers of all time. Mm-hmm. And, at his prime, they had such a good record against Liverpool. It was so painful. And what made it so painful is that they did it so beautifully. Arsenal at their prime, they were just so good at doing it. You know, like that 4-4 with Andre Arshavin, just out of this world. As much as it hurt, you couldn't help but sit there and admire.
Yeah.
And which kind of made it hurt even more.
Yeah.
Because you wanted that for yourself. You didn't want to be
beaten
by that. But it was just such beautiful football.
Yeah, well, he changed the game, didn't he? He really, like, revolutionized the game. So, I mean, yeah, his years and some of the teams that he had and that he built, you know, his ability to find, like, really raw players from overseas and bring them over and polish them into high quality players it was frightening, really. You look at players like Nicolas Anelka. I mean, I don't know if you remember him, but...
Of course.
Yeah, like, he brought him over. He probably bought him for like 500K, you know?
300, right, 300, right. Precisely. I remember.
Yeah.
Sold him for 30 million Real Madrid a couple of seasons later.
Yeah.
Basically built the Arsenal team off of that transfer. I mean, just got Anelka from nowhere, made 100X on him, flipped him like a shit coin almost.
I love it.
And in a sense, it was like that because Anelka, I remember it took him until the new year to score at Real Madrid. For some reason, without Wenger, he went to Real Madrid and he was just back to being the player that he was before he...
Incredible. So, yeah, no, and he's an economist, right, by background.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so he... he knows his stuff. I mean, maybe I should connect you with him so that I can try and connect you with him. He would love Bitcoin.
I would absolutely love to talk to Arsene Wenger. I cannot tell you how much I admire this man. And, you know, the reason I wanted to talk to you about football is because my understanding of time preference, which I speak about at the Bitcoin Standard, when I think of it, what helped develop my understanding of time preference is watching Arsene Wenger's Arsenal play low time preference football, because that's what they do. When you start playing football, when you're a kid, you just want to kick the ball into the goal. You know, you just want to be Ronaldo. You want to be Romario. You want to be Messi. You want to be the number 9, the number 10. You just kick it into the ball. And so, you know, when 5-year-olds and 8-year-olds are playing, it's a very high time preference game. It's just every kid wants to run at the ball and take it and put it into the goal. And the lowering of the time preference is to take a player and convince them that, look, yeah, you can take a shot every time you get the ball, but almost certainly you're not going to score. But if you take the ball, give it to your teammate, you can put them in a better position, and then they can put their other teammate in a better position. And then, you know, instead of cashing out on your possession right now by taking a shot, you invest it into a better possession. A better position.
Yes.
Possession at a better position for your teammate. Mm-hmm. And then he can either cash it out and take a shot or invest it and, you know, lower his time preference, delay the gratification, pass the ball on to his other teammate so that the teammate can do it. Right. So the joke about Arsenal was that they had to pass it into the goal.
Into the goal, yeah.
Because they would, you know, they couldn't just take a shot. They had to basically make the other team submit and then, you know, have Thierry right. Henry just waltz it into the net.
Yeah. It was, that's like, when you mention that, in that regard, it's so true because, and you know, there's many different ways to play the game, right? It's not to say that that is the right or there's no right or wrong way. You know, when I went to West Brom, I had to learn a whole different style of football. And you could say that under managers like Allardyce, you know, it probably was a bit, it was high preference style because, you know, you would have to take any opportunity that you could get because when you're playing at that level and you're playing against, you know, the best teams in the world, you ain't going to get many chances. So you have to take what you can get. And so there's just many different ways. But yeah, like you say, I mean, he would always teach us, you know, how to suffocate the opponent with possession because, you know, psychologically, we felt like we could win these games psychologically in the first 15, 20 minutes of a game because, you know, you feel like you can give them zero chance of even putting three passes together and they just feel like they're just bamboozled by, you know, a lot of possession and you can let them know it's going to be a long game. You know, within the first 20 minutes, and it goes back to, like you say, low time preference style football, which, you know, when you mentioned that to me, I thought it was really interesting because I never thought of it like that. But
it's quite remarkable that you got the archetype low time preference manager in Arsene Wenger and then the archetype high time preference manager in Sam Allardyce. Sam Allardyce
doesn't get more opposite than that.
It absolutely does not. Like, he was just standing there at the sideline telling his players to just kick the knee pads off of the opposition and get the ball to their big number 9 who will drop it down to their skillful number 10 who will bury it, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it helped me learn more about the game because that the only way I knew to play the game since I was, you know, 14 years old was the style that Arsenal play, you know. Yeah. So that was all I knew. I didn't really know how to play the game any other way because it was just embedded in me from such a young age. And so it was just all learning, you know, learning different ways to play. You know, these guys are successful managers still, right? That we're talking about just because it's a different
absolutely.
Style, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, there's I would say over time, the game has dropped its time preference. Like, you know, in the 1950s, it was a lot more direct. And over time, people have kind of advanced, but, you know, there's always different styles, and it's not a judgment on that style, whatever wins trophies, whatever works. And, you know, Mourinho came on later and basically did Sam Allardyce football with a European accent and got called genius for it.
Yeah, exactly. And he's done it with many different teams and won many different things. So, but yeah, it's just it got my mind racing when you mentioned about that because we have a lot of possession. We always have a lot of possession, and it reminded me of like the style of the Bitcoin network because it's like with every pass, it gets stronger, you know, and you just eventually suffocate the other team, the opposition, and it's just very similar. It's just so similar. So you've got my mind racing the last day or two.
That's amazing. You know, I interestingly enough, the current managing director of the IMF, Kristina Georgieva, was once trying to speak about how her what she views as the problems facing the world economy. And she thought that a major issue with the world economy is essentially, I mean, she looks like she's finally read some decent economics. She's come to the realization that the problem that they have is that they've been basically high time preference. In this video, she's sitting there with Christine Lagarde and Jerome Powell, and you know, it's a pretty high level discussion. And she's trying to explain what she views as the problem of short-termism in the way that in which they're taking their decisions. And basically, she makes the case for the same kind of analysis of football that we were discussing just now, but from an IMF's perspective.
I've seen this.
I think we are not paying sufficient attention to the law of unintended consequences. We take decisions with an objective in mind and rarely think through what may happen that is not our objective. And then we wrestle with the impact of it. Take any decision that is a massive decision, like the decision that we need to spend to support the economy. You know, at that time, we did recognize that may lead to too much money in circulation, too few goods, but didn't really quite think through the consequence in a way that upfront would have informed better what we do. And we act sometimes like 8 years old playing soccer. Here is the ball, we are all at the ball, and we don't cover the rest of the field. Our ability to deal with more than one crisis at one time is very, very limited.
What she's saying in it is that basically she likens global monetary policy and policymakers and central bankers to a bunch of eight-year-olds playing football. And she says when you have eight-year-olds playing football, they just all run to the ball. And they can't think about doing anything a little bit more sophisticated. And it's actually a very profound criticism of central banking. It's just a very high time preference institution that's about, you know, how do we stop the collapse from happening on my watch over the next 6 months? So I can pass the disaster off to the next guy and retire in peace and sell books. And so you always have the incentive to be that. It's amazing, like at their most profound moments when they really get this clarity, those policymakers arrive at the same kind of conclusions that the Austrian-minded people will arrive at, which is, look, this isn't going to end well. A series of high-time preference decisions, you know, is not going to work out in the long run. Even though it might work out in football for Sam Allardyce and Jose Mourinho, football's different, you know. For central banks and currency, the long term will catch up to you.
Absolutely.
It's only 90. You have to do it 90 minutes at a time in a football game.
Right.
But in real life, there's no final whistle.
No. It just keeps going.
Keeps going.
That's what they're doing. They're papering over the cracks, and they've been doing it for a while now. So it would be interesting to see what happens over the next, 3 to 4 years. But yes, it's exciting. And to be honest, the only thing that brings me peace is studying Bitcoin. You know, in a world of like chaos, it really is the only thing that can just settle me down. Because once I went down the rabbit hole, I was back in 2017.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah, I actually got introduced to it properly by one of my old teammates, Hal Robson-Kanu, who, when I first signed. I'd have to introduce you because, I mean, he is a blockchain expert. Like, I didn't realize, yeah. So he, when I first signed there, people would always make fun of him because he would come in and he would be the first one into training and he'd be in really early and he'd be just on his laptop, just going at it, just, you know, trading away, doing all of this fancy stuff on his laptop. And all of the other players used to make fun of him. So he was kind of like, it was kind of like the laughing stock a little bit of the dressing room when I first signed. And I didn't really know, I knew players because I played against them, but I didn't know anyone really personally. I was just curious. I'm just a curious guy. So I just parked up next to him and he schooled me for a year. We would go on the bus. I would sit next to him for away games. Most days in training, I would get, you know, whatever I could out of him. And then that was it, slowly but surely. And I lived in Birmingham at the time. So, I didn't really do much, especially my first season. I didn't really go back down to London a lot. So, you know, it was just, I spent a year or two really just doing as much as I could, you know, researching online, and just became more and more passionate about it. I think like something like this, it's very rare for something to, for me anyway, to keep me gripped every single day. Like it really fascinates me every single day. The invention, the history. And then when I started digging into your book, I mean, that was it. There was just no going back.
Wow. So I did not know that you'd been in this for this long. I thought your connection was that since you moved to Inter Miami, XBTO are the sponsors of Inter Miami. And I thought that's what got you interested in Bitcoin. But no, you've been in this field for a long time, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I just never really spoke about it. But I think moving here kind of just changed my way of thinking. And, you know, I think the reason why I announced like 50% of my salary in it is because I wanted to, you know, I would watch you guys all the time and followed you guys for a couple of years, Natalie, Brunel, Michael Saylor, all of the guys that I followed. And to be honest, I feel like it's probably one of the noblest things that you can do right now is, you know, try and get people to understand this. And so that's why, like, I look at you guys as economic saviors, because if you think about it, like, economically, the world is sick right now. And we need people like you. You're almost like our economic nurses and doctors trying to help the world, basically. So I've always just been big admirers of you guys. You know, I have a platform. I have a platform with people that follow me, and it was a way that I could at least try and raise awareness for people to look at it. And it was the only way that I thought I could, by announcing it anyway, it was the only way that I thought would at least, you know, even if it changed a few people's minds on looking more into it, it was something positive that I felt I could do. So that's kind of where that came from. Since 2017 was when I really started to get involved in it.
That's amazing. I'm very, very flattered, and it's very kind of you to say that. I'm very glad to hear that. It's mind blowing to me to one day I just came across some Bitcoin stuff and I saw your handle and I looked, and then you followed me, and I found that you were already following me, which was a big surprise for me, because I'm pretty crazy about football.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of my life watching and playing football. I still play today. I'm 41 and I still play about once a week.
Well, next time you're in Miami, we'll have to have a kick around.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I will take you up on that.
Anytime.
I've been getting into shape and practicing my kicks again, so I'll definitely want to take you up on that.
Perfect.
I want to talk more about Bitcoin, but I want to go back to football a bit. What do you think, how did Arsene Wenger do it with kids like you to turn you from 14-year-olds who wanted to just put the ball in the back of the net to patient Arsene Wenger players?
Well, I think, to be honest, I mean, during that era where he dominated the Premier League is just so iconic that everyone wanted to be like them. You know, I think if you look at even the best players in the world right now, or even over the last 10 years, a lot of them are Arsenal fans, or a lot of them were Arsenal fans. You know, you see pictures of legends of the game now when they were kids in their bedroom and they had posters up of, and most of the time it's of the Arsenal legends of the early 2000s. And so I just think that because his style of football was so revolutionary, every kid wanted to, especially growing up in London, wanted to play that way. So it didn't take much. He obviously didn't have to convince anyone that this was a successful way of playing football. It was pretty clear. So, you know, I mean, I signed there at 14. I signed from Wimbledon when Wimbledon went into administration and they moved to Milton Keynes. So it was just too far for my mom and family to drop me to training. And at that age, it was just, I grew up in South London. At that point, we'd played against Arsenal a few times and they asked, it was almost like a clear out of the whole academy. And so everyone was going to different teams now. And it was Liam Brady that was calling my parents and convincing them to let me come down and train. And, you know, my mum didn't really want me to do it at first because she just thought that she wanted me to focus on school and all of that stuff. But it was just, you know, it was just an opportunity that couldn't really turn down in the end. And then I was there from 14 to 16. And that's when you try and push to get a scholarship. So, I mean, I barely got a scholarship in the end because when I signed there, I was really shy. You know, all of the kids had all of the latest gear and we come from like a real working class club, Wimbledon, you know. So we turned up there. I came with my brother and it was just eye-opening. The facilities at that age that, you know, that we got was just incredible. And so it was overwhelming at that age, you know, to go there and just see all of the young kids that were just so good. But I managed to get a scholarship. And then that summer, you know, I knew I had a lot of work to do. I was 16. So I went away before the preseason, before going full time. I just got my head down and just worked really hard. And then I had a really good preseason that season. And then I managed to, you know, get opportunities to train with the first team when there were injuries. Yeah, I made my debut at 17, signed my first professional contract, and then that was it.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, it's the dream. It really is. Like, whatever I do in my life, it'll always be plan B next to having made it as a professional footballer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating industry. I'm not sure if you've watched the All or Nothing documentary on Amazon, but I highly recommend it. It will give you a really good insight into the daily life. I mean, I watched it recently and it's nostalgic because you know what the young players go through and you know, you don't really know much about the world, but you're just in this little bubble and there's just a lot of moving parts. So it kind of, I feel like it's brought the fans closer to the players and the club. You should definitely watch it. You should definitely watch it. I think if you watch it, you'll be inspired for sure. You'll be inspired for sure.
So you definitely would recommend for your children to pursue being professional footballers. You have no regrets about the career at all or pursuing it, right?
I mean, yeah, I think like my kids, I would let them do whatever they wanted. I would definitely make them aware of like everything that comes with it because not really much can prepare you for it.
Well, having a dad who's done it is decent preparation, I think.
Exactly.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
But yeah, no, I think it's a dream. It's a once in a lifetime. If you look at the statistics of even being able to play in the Premier League, you know, the chances of making a Premier League appearance is slim, to say the least. So, you know, it's always important to have other things.
Yeah, but one thing I like about football is that even the players who don't really make it, you know, your friends from the academy at Wimbledon and Arsenal who didn't end up making it as pros, you know, it doesn't really ruin their life. You know, they might make it in some lower club, make a little bit of decent income while they learn a trade. It isn't like in the US, because it's a small limited franchise model. Players who don't make it out of college to the big leagues, they just basically, it ends up being really, really expensive mistake in their life.
Right.
No recovering from it.
No. Well, the system's just totally different. You don't have relegation here.
Exactly.
So there's no pyramid. So if you're not playing in the NBA, the NFL, the MLB, then, you know, there's no filter. There's no way that you can progress through.
Yeah.
Get a promotion. And so it's just totally different here. It's totally different.
Yeah. And it's why I think the US and Canada struggle with developing talent. You know, you think that there's about as many people in the US and Canada as there are in Europe. And yet so many more players get developed in Europe because you have so many more clubs developing players, because if you develop players that play well, you can get into the top leagues. You know, any small club that develops a good academy can go very far. And in fact, the most successful clubs are the ones with the best academies. Like that's how you become Real Madrid and Manchester City and Liverpool and Arsenal. You have the best academies. And even if their players don't make it into Real Madrid or Arsenal or Manchester United, they sell a lot of these players. Yeah. And it's a significant source of income for these clubs that they sell Absolutely. To lower league players.
Yeah. But even the other way around, safe, right? Because if you think about it, like there's academies in the UK that are renowned for producing and not the big clubs, not the Uniteds, the Cities, the Chelseas. You know, you look at Southampton, you know, they're renowned. Gareth Bales, Theo Walcott, Alex Chamberlain's.
Crewe is another one.
Yeah, Leicester City, they have a really strong academy. And for them, it's even bigger because these clubs are making their money from breeding these players and then selling them on to bigger clubs.
Yeah.
So the business model is just, it's totally different to the US in that respect.
And it works better for the athletes, even the ones who don't make it, I think, in the European model, or really the global model. It's the whole world follows it except the US, basically.
Yeah.
Do you see this changing anywhere in the US? You play in the MLS now. What do you think?
I just think I mean, you look at what they're doing in Europe. They're actually trying to follow the US. So that's probably more what you've got to worry about. Because I remember what happened with the Super League.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to create more of a siloed entity to keep, because they're looking at it from purely business model, right? How many people really watch Fulham against Southampton? you know. Whereas if you can put all of the top teams into one league, you're going to have the best players in the world competing against each other on a much more regular basis.
Yeah, but it'll be unwatchable. Like, nobody wants to watch Real Madrid and Barcelona go at it 8 times a year. I mean, they did it for one season where they played in the Cup and then in the Champions League, and they played 5 times in a few months, and it was just...
Yeah, didn't have the same... Yeah. I agree, but... It's the big guys that are trying to push for, you know, maximum revenue at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, the US model works better for the club owners because, you know, it's a few franchise owners that make all the money, and it's essentially like a Ponzi because there's a limited number of spots and they keep trying to sell the spots for a higher price. You can't win your spot in the league on the pitch. And so all the money goes into the owners of this monopoly rather than going into developing talent, mm-hmm. which is why the US is so bad at football, because they don't develop talent.
Mm. I think they are improving. I do think soccer's getting bigger over here, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. But yeah, in terms of obviously compared to Europe, it is different.
Yeah, absolutely. But how do you enjoy living in Miami so far?
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's just it suited me nicely for, you know, the where I was at kind of in my life. I always wanted to play in another country at some point. And you know, there's just a lot of things going on in this city in particular at the moment. From more of a like a when you zoom out on the world and see what's going on, there's just it definitely suited me with me being into Bitcoin, for example. They're very pro Bitcoin here. I had a good conversation with the mayor about it. And what they're trying to do in this city is really fascinating. It's really fascinating. So it's just an exciting place to be on that front. And you know, the club is we're actually pretty strong at the moment. We're having a good season, I would say.
You're fifth, I think, at this point.
Yeah. So we're pushing for the playoffs, which is nice for the club. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
That's fantastic. So, big question: full-time Bitcoin or football management after your retirement? What do you see yourself doing?
I think football management for me, I'm not sure yet. I spoke to Jack Wilshere yesterday for the first time since he signed the for the under-18s Arsenal. So I had a good chat with him, and he's obviously one of my closest friends still in the game. So, you know, I can get a good insight into what it's really like. I definitely feel like I should probably stay in the game to some level, because there's a lot I feel that I can give back to the sport and to young kids in helping them develop in many different ways. But yeah, I feel strongly enough about Bitcoin to say that I would be excited to explore some avenues after I finish in that regard. So I think a mixture would be ideal for me.
It's an incredible thing about Bitcoin that people from all walks of life, they take the orange pill and it just becomes the most interesting thing going on. Basically, I think, you know, this becomes clear when you look at somebody like Michael Saylor, who's basically spent the last 2 years, spent a significant amount of time over the last 2 years on Bitcoin Twitter. And, you know, people from all over the world can get the same experience that Michael Saylor spends a lot of his time doing without having any of the resources of Michael Saylor, because it's just him at a screen looking at Bitcoin Twitter, and it costs practically nothing to do it.
Incredible, yeah.
It's the most amazing show in the world.
I wake up every day and I'm just like praying for a video from him. Like there is not a video that I haven't seen. There is not a video that I have not seen. I got lucky enough to meet him. I went to his house and met him a couple of times, and just the most fascinating guy, just the most fascinating guy. And it's so funny that you can just tell that if you're not talking about it, or it's not on topic of conversation at the moment for him, he's just not that interested. He's just not that interested. So, but fascinating guy, fascinating guy. I have to chase him up again soon and just pick his brain.
Yeah, maybe we could all hang out next time I'm in Miami. We'll have a lot of fun. Yeah.
Definitely.
So what do you think in terms of sportsmen and Bitcoin? Let's get back to Bitcoin now. What do you see in terms of the, do you see a lot of sportsmen becoming open to the idea? Do they see the synergy? Because in my mind, I think, you know, the stories about athletes who retire and go broke very quickly are just so enormous. And it's because of the inflation, you know, you can't be an athlete and focus on winning trophies and also manage a portfolio. Like, you can't do it if you're a dentist or a doctor or an engineer or an athlete. If you have a job that requires focus and dedication, it's not going to allow you to follow what's going on with the IMF and the Bank of Japan and commodity market. I think basically all high performing people in any field have to zone that stuff out and focus. And for athletes, that means trusting others with managing their money. And without the expertise of knowing how to assess and manage and hire people to do this, a lot of them end up with very bad stories. So I would say that there'd be a natural appeal among athletes with Bitcoin. I know Stefan de Vrij, the Dutch central defender and Inter Milan central defender, he's also a big-time Bitcoiner. But what about the rest of them? What do you think?
So, from my experience, when I announced it, I did have quite a few people reaching out to me to ask about it, and a few players at the club as well. It's just so fascinating that I think for me, it's like you say, once you've kind of gone down the rabbit hole, I find it fascinating some of the questions that are asked. For example, you know, I announced 50% in, I think it was December. And obviously, I don't know, the thing was at like 60K then, and there's been a 70% drawdown, and people think that I've lost all of my money, right? So, but they don't know that I do this every month, where I still get paid by the club. I just have a deal with XBTO separately that 50% gets, when it hits my account, goes to them, and then they convert it and send. So it's kind of like a dollar cost average. But obviously for people that don't know about this, they think that I've just lost 60% of my salary. And so you have to really start from the beginning, because people just don't know about it. So I feel like once I break those first few, you know, questions, the penny starts to drop a little bit more. And so I think that that's just what's going to happen slowly with people once they get their head around, you know, how you can get paid in Bitcoin and why this will benefit you in the long term. I think more and more people will, you know, will warm to it. But it's just still, if you haven't done the work on it, you're just not going to know. And the people that are managing all of the athletes, and not just athletes, but like you say, most people that don't manage their own money, that it's the people behind them that you need to really get into, you know, because the first thing these athletes are going to do is look for advice from their financial advisor. Right. And in these financial advisors, who are they working for? What company are they working for? Are they pro Bitcoin? Do they not like to touch it? Do they find it risky, so that they're not going to want to risk losing their clients' money? And so I think it's more the people behind these athletes that is more important, because at the end of the day, I might know, you know, I might know enough about it for myself, but for me to go and tell someone about it, they have to trust me. And I'm just a footballer. You know, I don't have any credibility. I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not a blockchain expert. I've just done enough work that's given myself enough conviction to go and do this. I think at the end of the day, you have to do a certain amount of work. And I just consider myself lucky that I was curious enough to look at this, because that's what they say about the early Bitcoiners had three things that, or one of three things that no one else had. And it's intelligence, curiosity, and conviction. So if you didn't have one of them, you probably didn't do the work on Bitcoin, right? And so I feel like for me, it wasn't so much intelligence. It was curiosity for me. It was curiosity and conviction for me that really, that I feel lucky that I had that in order to get involved in this. But if you don't have one of those three things, then, you know, you're probably going to be behind.
I mean, I disagree with you. I think you don't manage to get to where you got in the game and also manage to get Bitcoin on the side without a significant amount of intelligence on top of your curiosity and conviction. It's really impressive that you've gotten into this, because I can imagine, as you said, ultimately you have to surround yourself with people that manage your money. And these people, it's a job for them. And the problem with Bitcoin is that, in a sense, it puts them out of the job. It's saying to athletes that you don't have to be hiring somebody to follow what's going on in global interest rates and wars and geopolitics and commodity markets and supply chains, right, in order to know where to invest and beat inflation for the next 10, 15 years of your career. You just need to stack sats. And over time, you know, by the time you retire 10 years from now, there's going to be only a much smaller increase in Bitcoin than in, yes, pretty much everything else. It's just betting on that rather than managing the money day to day. So it's, I can see kind of the conflict of interest that prevents it, because they're likely to go to their trusted money person and say, hey, what do you think about this? And that person is going to see, you know, even with the best of intentions, they just don't likely like a scenario that involves putting them out of a job.
Right. Yeah. That's what you're facing. That's literally what you're facing. And most of these guys, they don't manage their own money, like you say. So, you know, It's gonna take, I feel like it's gonna take time, but I think you will definitely start to see it with high net worth individuals at first, because, you know, the way they see it is they have a significant, you know, significantly more money than the average person. I feel like it goes back to when we were saying about the high time preference football is, if you get a chance to shoot, even if you're 30 yards out, you've got to take it, because you don't know when your next opportunity is going to come. And it's like, you know, the average individual, they have enough trouble trying to pay rent every month and bills. And so if they don't understand this thing, how are they expected to, you know, say, put a portion of their salary aside, or their savings aside, to put it into something that they don't understand? It's just going to be unlikely that people are willing to do that. And so, which kind of, it saddens me a little bit, because, you know, I feel like this, the whole idea of Bitcoin is for these people, you know, for the people that don't have access to a bank, people that, you know, just feel like they're always two steps behind in their life, and they just can't get ahead, and they just feel like they're just in this wheel that is just going round and round, and there's just no way out. That's you know, I feel like primarily it's more for them. And what I don't want, and which was why I kind of announced the salary thing, just even if it helped a few people try and research it, is, you know, you don't want, the time is kind of now, really, rather than in 10 years when, you know, the thing is a lot further on down the line and the network's 500 times stronger. You know, it's not to say that they've missed the boat, because in my view, I don't think you're going to miss the boat for a while on this, because the potential of it is so big. But, you know, the earlier, the better, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. What have you found has been effective in communicating Bitcoin's value proposition with your fellow athletes?
Yeah.
If, you know, for the average Bitcoin Standard podcast listener who's trying to orange pill their local athlete, what do you think is the kind of good selling point that has worked?
The one that always works well for me is introducing them about market cap, because it gives you a clear view or scope as to where it can actually go. And so I normally try and start with, all this is being able to email gold. And so I compare it to gold first. And then I say, okay, well, if the market cap of gold is 10 trillion and currently this thing, I don't know, is 500-600 billion, you know, we just live in a digital world now. So it just makes sense. You know, like I try to tell them about revolutionary technologies and how they have advanced. And then I say, you know, you would like to think that this thing next will just eat gold. And it will just swallow gold. And so there's a 10x from there. And I feel like that raises eyebrows the most for me when I speak to people about it.
Yeah, I guess it's a good place to start, because ultimately it makes a lot of sense. And you put it this way, because yeah, there's this many coins out there, and we know that for sure. And you know, you can say with confidence, you have a node that says exactly how many coins there are right now, and you can buy and sell one of these at any of these exchanges for this much. I think that's a very good way of anchoring people into the reality of this. Like, it's a thing that exists on people's computers, but you can buy it and sell it on exchanges. Mm-hmm. And there's, as we speak, about $400 trillion. No, wait, $400 billion. Ah, this inflation means we're losing track of zeros. I don't think any generation has had to do numbers at so many digits. Like, we currently, except for fiat, you know, 20th century. But we currently, you know, in our day-to-day, we pay for things in the range of a dollar, half a dollar, $2. And then when you think about what government is doing, you're thinking in the range of trillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. That's 12 zeros. This is a lot. I don't think people had to do this much math before.
Yeah. We're just inventing more and more bigger numbers at this point.
Yeah, I think soon... spoiler alert, what comes after trillion is quadrillion.
Quadrillion.
So, it's going to soon come in. There's soon going to be mentions of quadrillion dollars in supply.
Yeah.
So yeah, Bitcoin is still only $400 billion, which is, you know, not huge, but also not nothing. Right. It's a huge market. It's bigger than most companies, say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another one as well. That's another one that I use. Is that it was the fastest thing to reach a trillion in market cap in less than 10 years, faster than Google, Amazon, Facebook, all of those. So that raises eyebrows as well.
Nice. So what do you think in terms of, do you have ideas about what you want to do in the Bitcoin space moving forward? Are you still focusing on your football career for now?
Yeah, I'm still focusing on it, but it definitely it's because it's a passion of mine. It's just what I do in my spare time. So when I'm bored picking up your book, I haven't started the Fiat Standard yet, by the way, but I will be starting that soon. A big thing that I would love to do is try to because I'm from Barbados. My dad's from Barbados. Mm-hmm. So that he lives there, and a lot of my dad's family live there. So, and obviously I live in Miami now, so I'm close to there. But a dream of mine would be to get in touch with the prime minister there and convince them to make Bitcoin legal tender in the country. But you know, I've not managed to. I'm working on at least trying to get an introduction. I've met the Minister of Finance once, but it's just, you know, it's not an easy task. But that would be a dream of mine to do that.
Yeah,
because you know the country is a tiny island. They left the Republic in December. I don't know if you saw that. They
left the monarchy.
They left the monarchy. Sorry, yeah. So now they are they're a republic. So there's just obviously going to be a lot of changes in the country. So I mean, it's part of my heritage, you know. So that would be one of the things that I'd love to do.
Yeah.
So maybe you can help me. We can fly there together.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. I can handle going to Barbados. I don't think that's a bad place.
Yeah, beautiful island.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it would be great. And it's very close to Miami, where you are.
Yeah, yeah. It is, yeah. I went in June for a few days and we had a break to just go over there. And it's a beautiful island. But yeah, I mean, things like that. I would like to create an academy here. I'm working on it currently at the moment.
Nice.
So I'm thinking, you know, there could be an idea to do a Bitcoin academy, you know, not only football lessons to the kids, but also Bitcoin lessons. And I'm lucky enough to, since I moved here and announced the salary thing, that I have you know, created a nice community here of good Bitcoin guys, and I'm sure I could raise a bit of money, keep the whole balance sheet in Bitcoin anyway for the academy, you know, charge a small amount. I wouldn't want to make a lot of money off of it. It's just a way that I can give back to young kids out here, because so many kids want to play out here, you know. So I'm currently thinking of ways to structure it where I could, you know, give them an incentive to not only study the game of football, but also to study Bitcoin. So I could maybe offer a discount if they're willing to do just, even if it's an hour a week, and just bring in experts to just talk to the teenagers about it. So yeah, that's an idea of mine that I've had.
Nice.
So yeah, I'll be following up on you about that as well.
Absolutely. Maybe
if I did it one day, you could come down and speak to the young, the next generation, you know?
Yes. And maybe I'll invest in some of their contracts. Maybe we'll get the next
perfect
superstar.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. As long as they take their salary in Bitcoin, I'll be happy.
Yeah. As long as they stack in Bitcoin, the more important is to stack in Bitcoin as well. Yeah. That's the scoreboard that we play against. You know, these are the goals.
Yeah.
How many do we stack? How many people do we have stacking?
Yeah. I mean, you could do that. You could do that, right? You could charge people a small amount for these academies, and you just hold it in Bitcoin anyway, right? You could just hold it in Bitcoin for five years. And then reinvest the money into the academy to make it bigger. It's definitely an idea. I'll pick your brain about it over the next couple of months.
Absolutely. Happy to chat anytime.
Great.
All right. We have another question for you from Peter. Peter?
Yeah, thanks, Kieran. I wanted to ask a question about one of the points you made earlier in the podcast about the economic model being different. And you said that in the US, they have a model where they're more pursuant of profit. And then in Europe, they have a different kind of model with the leagues where it's maybe focused on something else. I just wondered if you could explain that a bit further, because I'm not too familiar with how the funding works. And why is it that if there is a different way way of running the leagues that is more profitable? Why is it that that hasn't been implemented? Is there a specific reason for that?
Well, I think back in Europe, it's because football isn't about profit, right? It's a working class sport, and people want to see, people want to be able to see Leicester winning the league, right? Which is just one of the most iconic, unique events in sporting history. But you can't have that here. You can't have a team that's, climbed up however many leagues and go and do something like that, because once you're in the NFL, you're in the NFL. You don't come out. It's just a franchise. But I think it just, America is fundamentally built on capitalism, right? So that's just how they are as a nation. Whereas back home, it's a little bit more socialist than here. And I think that's why, there was so much uproar when they were trying to do the Super League, because the people back home that go and spend, all of their savings on going to watch their club, they want to see that one day a team that's in League One could get promoted to the Premier League. And these special moments are what football is about. So I think that's why there was so much backlash on the Super League stuff. And then over here, for them to change that, I think it would kind of go against what their country is about. It would be like they were going backwards, if that makes sense.
I'm going to have to slightly disagree here with you. With all due respect, we are a very capitalist-friendly space here, so I'm going to make the case for capitalism. Why I think it's kind of the other way around. In fact, I think the European system is more of a capitalist system, because you have free competition between clubs, in that anybody can own a club. You and I can go and set up a club anywhere in the world, except the US and Canada right now, and literally become world champions. We can work our way up from the Vietnamese third division, where we start, or sixth division, work our way up to become Vietnamese champion, Asian champion, and then world champions. Mm-hmm. Or we could do it in England, or we could do it in Africa. The only place where you cannot do that is America and Canada. You start a club here, you play in your local league, and that's it. You win your local league 10 years in a row, there's no other league for you to play in. Yeah. You don't get bigger. You need to get $100 million and go buy your spot in the MLS.
Yes.
Which is essentially like a system that's protected. It protects club owners at the expense.
Right.
It protects 30 club owners at the expense of thousands of smaller club owners and thousands of young players and thousands of fans in these small towns. You don't have the equivalent of small town clubs in England. Brentford, they beat Manchester United last week 4-0.
Yeah.
And 12 years ago, Manchester United were close to being European champions. They lost the final to Barcelona in the season in which Brentford were finishing, I think, eighth in League Two, which is the fourth division. Yeah. So there's about 100 places between them. One was playing Barcelona in the Champions League final, and the other one was playing in a league nobody watches. Well, not nobody, but people in that town watch it. People in Brentford go to watch their club. They get 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 fans, but they work their way up, but now they beat Manchester United. Yeah. I think that's more of a capitalist system, in that you have free competition between all of these clubs.
Yeah.
And I think this is why fans protested in Europe, because they didn't want, Liverpool fans didn't want to have to play Arsenal and Manchester United all year long and just continue to play this. No, I think it's much better when you have to play Crystal Palace and West Brom and Manchester United and Arsenal, where you have to win your place in the league every year, because you could get relegated. Yes. Manchester United would get relegated this season if they continue to play terribly. Who knows? It's happened to big clubs before. It's happened to them, and we can hope.
I like that he's thrown that in there. The United could get relegated this year. But I do agree. I think that the American owners, they would just, the reason they wouldn't do it is because they're not going to take on that risk. If you get relegated from the Premier League, you're losing a lot of money, right?
But I mean, a lot of people will take on the risk to get to the Premier League. So yeah, the big current owners, a lot of them will end up having to play in a lower division. Boo hoo! But you know, maybe don't suck on the pitch. Yeah, and win. That's the whole point of the sport.
Yeah. Exactly. That's why it's just so it is alien for Europeans to not have relegation. They just don't understand. Yeah. They don't understand the system here.
No, it makes no sense that a lot of the regular season games just end up being meaningless, because if you're not going to make playoffs, then you're not going to make playoffs. It doesn't matter. So you don't care if you finish. In fact, it's better for you to finish bottom because you get a better draft pick. It's perverse.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of games unwatchable, but in the Premier League, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible, the difference. It took me a while to adjust, but like, I think since being here for a year, like I love NBA. I love the NBA. Yeah. I've gotten really into that. But yeah, in terms of the feeling of, you know, promotion, relegation, getting into Europe, staying in the league.
Yeah, you got relegated and promoted with West Brom, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You've done it all.
So these feelings are you can't really recreate that for fans, for players, for people involved in the clubs. You know, it's high stake.
It's incredible to think that, you know, small town where, you know, 10 years ago you could go and pay £5 to watch your local team and you knew the local players, and then 10 years later they're out there beating Cristiano Ronaldo 4-0. You're paying 10 times as much, but you're getting to beat Cristiano Ronaldo and Manchester United 10-0.
But no, I agree. Like, I feel like the system back home would just always be that more special, because like you say, here, once you're at the top, you're at the top for good until, you know, someone else comes along and buys you or whatever. But I have to agree. Being the European system, I'll probably always favor more.
Yeah, I think it's the reason why Europe develops much better players, because you have a lot more competitive football at every level. You know, under 15s is competitive in England, because having valuable under 15s, you know, you could sell them or they could get you into, you know, in a couple of years they could get you into the first team and they can get you promoted. So there's high stakes all along. But here in the US, unfortunately, in the US and in Canada, there's no added value from developing young players. They can't get you into the MLS. Yeah. So very few people invest into small local clubs. And it's sad, because clubs play an enormous role in keeping kids off the street. I mean, we've been teenage boys and we know that, you know, football really is what keeps a lot of kids out of gangs, out of trouble, out of doing drugs, out of doing all kinds of insane things. Having to wake up and play football is great. It's great motivation, discipline. That's what local clubs do.
Sure. It teaches you more than just the game of football from a young age, for sure.
Tell us more. Which other footballers do you know are orange-pilled? Or at least, you know, the ones that are comfortable being public about it. Perhaps some of them are not comfortable being public.
Other players... There are a couple back home that, just from speaking to me, have actually gotten involved in. I won't name them because I haven't pre-warned them that I was doing this.
Okay,
players that are. But I spoke to Hal, so he said that he was happy for me to let him know that I was going to mention him, because I have to give a lot of thanks to him, because he was the one that kind of got me into it. You know, I called him to make sure that I could mention him, and he's a great guy. But in terms of other players, there's a few players that buy it, but you know, how heavily they're involved, I'm not so sure, to be honest.
Are you still in touch with Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
I am. Nice. Still a close friend.
If you want me to orange pill, I'd be very happy to. He's a current Liverpool player, so I.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll drop him a message.
I deliver him a special personal orange pill anytime.
he's just had a baby, so he's playing daddy right now. So nice. might be a good time to get him. Might be a good time to get him now that he's a dad.
Oh, well, send him my congratulations.
Yeah, I will.
Okay. Peter has another question for you.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks very much. So it was interesting to hear that you got into Bitcoin in 2017. That was the same year that I got into Bitcoin as well. And I just wanted to hear your perspective on the rate of adoption that you've seen, particularly given that you've lived in the UK and the US.
Yeah.
Have you been surprised by how like fast or slow adoption has been? I personally would have expected to be a lot further forward than it is in the UK when I started out in 2017.
Yeah.
Does that match your experience? And what's it like in the US in comparison?
Well, it's so much more advanced here for sure. But when I was studying it back in 2017, I remember reading and just, you know, started to follow the community on Twitter and stuff like that. And when I was learning about it and I was reading that, you know, countries were going to adopt this as legal tender and companies were going to put it on their balance sheet. And I wasn't convinced because I'd only just started studying it. So the fact that, you know, looking back now at that and seeing that companies are actually doing it and countries are implementing it, it's that for me is fascinating in just 5 years. So I think for me personally, it's actually gone a lot further than I would have first anticipated at this point, because I never even when I was studying it, I never really thought that, you know, it was gonna pick up this traction so quickly. But moving here has made me think how slow it has been back home, to be honest. Just because it's just everywhere here. You see ATMs, you see shops accepting it. And so you just don't really see that back home. So yeah, I would say it's kind of like a middle ground for me, just because of what I was reading before and the people that were saying that all of these things were going to happen, and then it's just happening right before your eyes. It's just fascinating to see. Fascinating.
Amazing. Max has another question for you.
Yeah, hi. When speaking to Bitcoiners or plebs, one thing that a lot of people are experiencing is like, once they understand Bitcoin and go down the rabbit hole, their life changes radically. So for me personally, I've been like interested in way other topics than I was before. I was like educating myself in other ways and also changing my whole diet and working out. So I would be interested if Bitcoin had this impact on your life, and if it did so, in what kind of sense?
It probably did, you know, after I read Saifi Dean's book, it slowed me down. It slowed me down a lot more, you know. I spent a lot of time, I have a lucky enough also to have a lot of friends that are involved in various different types of businesses. And, you know, I'm lucky enough that I get presented with a lot of investment opportunities. And I think it just, you know, I was always 100 miles an hour reading people's decks and trying to think about, you know, where I can put my money into different speculative startups. And it really just like made me just take a step back, because I do enjoy doing all of that stuff. But at the same time, there's just a piece that comes with buying Bitcoin that I have. And so now I'm just, you know, I'm a lot more selective now. If I think about, you know, would I rather a Ferrari or for 200K, or would I prefer to, you know, add a few more Bitcoins to my wallet?
Easy decision, right?
It's just a no-brainer, you know. I mean, luckily I've never really been into like flashy cars and stuff, but I mean, at this point, it just gives me this makes me think more about the long term. Makes me think more about the long term. And that's you know, a lot of that comes down to Saifi Dean's thinking. And that's why I'm thankful, because that book really kind of changed. It changed my life in that regard. You don't have to run around all the time, like all the time doing all of this crazy stuff, trying to outbeat inflation and, like, you know, working super hard. I like to think I've worked pretty hard so far, and I just need to find something to store what I've earned in a safe place. And that's for me what Bitcoin does.
That's amazing. It's incredible to hear this. Like, I was writing this stuff in a book years ago, and then seeing it come back to me from Kieran Gibbs is just absolutely mind blowing. Not the future I expected, but I love it.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure. When you messaged me on Twitter, it was like a pinch me moment, because you guys helped. You just helped, you know, trying to help so many people, and it's admirable. It's admirable what you guys are doing. So yeah, I just thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thomas, do you mind taking another question from Thomas? I'll follow up.
Sure.
Yes. So basically, what I was trying to go with my question is that as a gunner, I've struggled all my life seeing RE going to Barcelona, Van Persie leaving, all of these great players, you know, leaving the club. So my idea is, like, maybe in a world of Bitcoin, where, let's say, in the future we have Bitcoin, which is a stable money, which is non-inflationary, maybe these teams, these clubs, which are, let's say, Arsenal, they're not as rich as Man City, or they're not as rich as Real Madrid, they can have more financial stability to not sell players like, and break our hearts, like players like Ari. Like, if you look in the past, you have like Steven Gerrard and Pirlo, all of these great players, they stayed with their hometown teams, not Steven Gerrard, I guess, but they stayed with their local teams in the end. So maybe with Bitcoin, these clubs will have like more stability, and the players will stick around with their teams longer than, because we grow as fans, we grow to love players.
Sure, sure.
And when we see them go to our rival teams, that breaks my heart. So maybe that's something Bitcoin can fix.
I agree. I agree in the respect of players that leave because they want to earn more money, right? Because you've got some players that left that obviously leave because they have an opportunity to change their life even more for their families and their hometowns and whatever. But you also have some players that leave not just for financial reasons. And so I'm not sure Bitcoin can fix that, but it can definitely fix it for the first point, you know, for players that want to leave because they, you know, they feel like they're underappreciated financially. So, but also it can help the clubs that are early adopters of this. If you get a club now that's in League One or League Two, you know, and they put this and they take a punt and put this on their balance sheet in 10 years, then, you know, they could build a foundation that can really climb them up the leagues and invest into the club. Yeah, I think it can help for that reason as well.
Yeah, I think now that you mentioned it, Thomas, I think another way it occurs to me now is that the reason we get so many problems like Manchester City and Chelsea Football Club, as Arsenal and Liverpool fans, we both agree these are pestilences that shouldn't be there in football. But a big reason why these things happen is that the people who own all of that money don't have a decent store of value, don't have a place to put money into it. So if you happen to make $10 billion, you get to a point where you buy a football club, because what else are you going to do? Where else are you going to put your money? You can't hold cash. You can't just keep buying more US dollar treasuries. You can't just keep buying stocks forever, and you can't follow the stock market. And at some point, it becomes more fun to go and just buy Chelsea Football Club and go and watch them and, you know, mess around with Jose Mourinho instead. But I think in a world in which you can just hold money and expect it to appreciate and not have to worry about this, I think a lot of those people would not get into football in the first place, and football would be run by the football people. So instead of having, you know, an Abramovich finance Mourinho to be a force of evil in football, you would just simply have Arsene Wenger up against Liverpool every season.
Yeah.
And no oligarch money, no...
Yeah, it washes out all of the... yeah, you're right. Yeah. But these guys love football as well, I believe.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, how I don't know, the Bitcoin raises the opportunity cost. Currently, the opportunity cost is you buy bonds and you buy all these awful things. But with Bitcoin, you know, you can have more Satoshis. There's nothing better than more Satoshis.
Agreed.
Yeah. All right. Well, the other major thing we need to talk about is the World Cup. What are your thoughts on the World Cup? This coming World Cup, obviously.
Yeah. Being in Qatar?
No, the...
You mean just... What do I...
Football. Yeah, who are you tipping?
I still think England have a really good chance. I mean, but it's just hard to write off France. I mean, the abundance of talent in the French national team for the next decade looks pretty strong.
Yeah,
I have to say. So it would be hard to write them off. So I would probably say them.
Yeah, that's a good guess in my opinion. I think the French have just incredible amounts of talent. Like they could have three major superstars injured and not miss them. That's just
right,
so
right,
much depth
right.
They have.
Yeah. What do you think?
I have a strange hunch that I think maybe this is going to be one major twist in the tale for the Cristiano Ronaldo / Messi saga. I think one of those two might win it, and I'm leaning more towards Cristiano Ronaldo. I think Messi has had a season at PSG in which he's basically phoned it in, and he's focusing on this World Cup. Cristiano Ronaldo's also basically phoning it in for Manchester United this season. You know, he was late for preseason, and he doesn't really seem to care much. He was trying to get out if he can, but I think he definitely wants to get
one last hurrah.
And
it would be nice to see.
I think Portugal have a much better team than Argentina. Like they still have a lot of depth. You know, in defense, in midfield, they've got some very good players.
Yeah,
not a surprise.
Yeah, agreed. I like the look of Brazil just on the offensive side. It just looks strong as well. It'd be fascinating to watch. I'm really looking forward to that this year.
Yeah. And on the fact of Qatar, I have a hunch it's going to be, from a footballing perspective, it's going to be the ideal World Cup, because all stadia are within 30 kilometers from one another. So basically all the national teams are just going to get into a hotel and stay there for 4 or 5 weeks and not have to travel, not have to worry about checking into a new place, not have to worry about acclimatization. Mm-hmm. They get in, they acclimatize, and it's going to be perfect weather. That time of the year in Qatar, it's perfect weather. It's not going to be too hot or too cold.
Yeah.
And they're just going to be there focusing on the football. I think that's going to really be something different, because every World Cup, there's always something, maybe not every, but with most World Cups, there's something with the travel that gets in the way of the experience. You know, teams have to move so much and can be exhausting, or they have too much travel. I think Qatar will be very interesting in that regard.
Yeah, for sure. Because you look at 2026, and that's going to be in the US, and they've already, I think it's the US, I don't know if it's Canada, and I think Mexico as well, they're hosting.
Yeah, it's all three of them.
Yeah, so... That's a lot of travel. We traveled last week to San Jose, and then played 3 days later in Montreal. So it was, you know, literally a cross country trip, and it was tough. It makes me think about the traveling that all the NBA guys in that have to do. Like, it's incredible. These guys are playing every 2-3 days. It made me really, because I used to think, oh, it's a bit different because, you know, they it's roll on, roll off. They can get substituted. They can come off and on. And so I used to think physically it wasn't as tough as football, but just being here for the last year and following an NBA season and then me and then traveling myself to play games away in different states, it made me just, it changed my whole perspective on what these guys are doing. Like, it's incredible. It's really incredible to be able to travel every few days during a season to different states and playing at such a high level. But even the World Cup here in the US in 2026, like I'm going to be really excited for that. You know, it's a few years away.
Yeah, it's going to be huge. I mean, imagine trip from Mexico City to Montreal and then to Vancouver.
Yeah.
And I think some teams are going to have to do that, you know, between a quarterfinal, semifinal and a final right. for the World Cup, which is right. incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
I think one more question. I think Daniel's going to want to have a question. Daniel's a hammer, an ex-hammer, I think. He's recovered. Daniel?
Yeah. Daniel, oh, there yeah, it is. Recovered. A recovered hammer. funnily enough, Bitcoin was part of that journey, you know? It started making me realize how much time and effort I was putting in and money into, you know, so supporting these... I know Saif and I are going to disagree on this one heavily because he still puts a lot of time and effort and money into it. It changes us in different ways. I'd like to know, you know, has it changed your game in any way? The way that you anticipate the game, the way you approach the game, like mentally, physically, what's happened there? And I'm sorry if that's already been covered.
No, it hasn't. I don't think it's changed my game. But I think it's changed just it's probably just changed my life in general. Talking about Bitcoin, right? I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just changed my life in general. I'm just a lot more patient with things. It brings me a sense of calmness and peace, to be honest, that not so I'm less irritable about things. I'm less worried about money. And I don't like to think about money so much. I like to just, you know, do simple things in my life. But in terms of on the pitch, no, I don't think it's changed. I don't think it's changed my game at all, and how I play the game.
It hasn't made you a carnivore yet.
Interesting.
It hasn't made me a carnivore.
No.
No. Nah. Everyone's a vegan now, safe in the Premier League. Remember, like yeah, we're going to go plant based, and you know, this is the science. Follow the science, and the. that's interesting as well around the money, because you guys, you have sharks swimming around you all the time. With financial advice and, you know, people coming out of left field, pretending to have your best interests at heart. Those young kids that are just making it, right? 18, 19, 20, all of a sudden they're getting the big pay package. The phone's going to start ringing and there's bad actors there with really bad advice. You know, yeah. How do you hope Conor Okus as well? I mean, ex-West Ham, he never made the big time, but, you know, he's a Bitcoiner, football Bitcoiner, and there's a couple in the States.
Who's that, sorry?
Conor Okus.
Okay.
He came up through the ranks at West Ham. Do you know Alex Crunelli? He plays at Birmingham.
No, I don't.
And Lucky Mukasana. He plays for Tampa Bay Rowdies. These are Bitcoiners in the US, professional footballers.
Oh, so, interesting.
It's definitely, I mean, we need more of you guys in the changing rooms. Helping educate those guys that have, you know, this expendable money that they're being pushed to malinvestment, bad investments, that's just paying commission to these financial advisors and these other guys. So I hope you you can reach some of your especially the younger guys coming through.
I mean, I definitely, like, it got to a point where, like, a lot of them were asking me individually, just training and phone calls. And it did kind of make me think, like, maybe I could do, I don't know, just whether it's a seminar or something that stops me from having to have the same conversation many times and just get a group together. I offered the boys to do just a talk when we go to away games, because I said to them, it's probably best that, you know, we just get, because obviously when we travel, we're together a lot. It'd be nice to just at least go through my experience and how I got into it with them, like at an away game at a hotel when we're just doing nothing. And it also saves me from having the same conversation to different players all the time. So I might try and revisit that.
Maybe we should do a Bitcoin for Athletes video, you and I.
I'd love that. I'd love that. And I'm sure that I would it would gain a lot of traction. I'm sure it would.
No Manchester United or Chelsea players need apply. We'll do them an intro to some shitcoin.
we could also like just do like Zoom in call. Any of us are available on this call. Anyone put their hand up to help you out if you just wanted to do a Zoom in and answer, just fire questions at us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
100%.
I just saw a comment there also, no Tottenham, please. I love that.
All right, final question. What was the best West Ham United player you ever played against?
That's a good question. Payet.
Yeah.
Dimitri Payet. He was a great player. I'm really good friends with Mark Noble. Because I did the under 21 European Championships with him. 13 years ago, which is crazy. So he's a good friend of mine. He was actually in Miami last week, and I met up with him. Because he's retired now. Mm-hmm. There's a West Ham legend there.
Yeah, no time preference, one club. He's a born Bitcoiner.
Yeah. I didn't actually get to speak to him about it, but yeah, there's another one that I could get on the call.
Nice.
So what do you think? We're happy to do this, right? I mean, let's get absolutely.
I was going to ask you, who was the best player you've ever played with and against, if you were to say?
Best player I've played against, Eden Hazard.
Oh, wow.
Eden Hazard.
I did not expect that answer, but yeah, he was incredible at his
prime. For sure. He had one season at Chelsea where it was just unplayable. So I would say him. Best player I've played with, Santi Cazorla.
Oh, wow.
Santi Cazorla.
You played with Thierry Henry.
Yeah, but I was young when he was, I didn't play. Yeah. But when he came back for like 3 months. So I played with him then, but not when he was obviously during the Highbury days. I was too young.
Oh, okay.
Were you on the pitch when he scored that goal against Leeds?
I wasn't. I wasn't on the pitch, but I was there.
Any football fan watching that was
incredible moment, incredible. But yeah, Santi for me was just an alien. He was just an alien from day one. All of the players just couldn't believe it. The way that the guy, his balance, his left foot to his right foot was just no different. You could make a run and you wouldn't even have to look. You could just focus on, you know, what was in front of you and the direction that you were running in, because you knew that the ball was probably just going to literally land right in front of you at the perfect time. And his agility. And I just loved him because he's not your model like footballer, you know. He's not big, he's not that fast, and to play at that level, you know, for someone of his size showed you just how good technically he was, that he was a master. He was a master of the game. So I think most people that I don't know for sure, but if I was to ask most people that played with him during that time when he played, most people would say the best player they played with was him. That's a guess, but I would say most players would say him.
That's amazing. He was incredibly good, but I did not expect that answer. I remember when he retired, I saw a picture online of his ankle, and he had incredible damage done to his ankle over time. It was horrific.
It was one of the saddest things to see during that time, actually, because it was over time. And I remember he was moaning about his Achilles for a while before he'd actually gone and had the surgery. And he was flying back to Spain a lot to see doctors there. And he was really struggling. And then, I think it was like infection or something. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And the pictures of his looked worse in person. It looked worse in person. Oh, and they had to do a skin graft and, take a patch of skin from his arm and cover it over the damaged infection, because it was just completely dead. So yeah, he really went through it in the end, which was sad for such an incredible player. And more than anything with him, he was just the nicest guy. He was just funny. He was so good for his mood for the changing room. You know, if we'd had a loss or if we had, we was having a rough patch, he was instrumental in always, you know, keeping the mood up of the camp. Incredible guy.
That's amazing. I was just checking his Wikipedia and I found out he hasn't even retired yet. He's still playing. Yeah. He's playing in Qatar.
In Qatar, yeah. Yeah, he's still playing there, yeah. Yeah, he went back to... I mean, he was... Even when he left, he went back to Villarreal, was it? Did he go to
Villarreal? He was in Villarreal.
Yeah, he really came back there. Like, he was really good. The fact that he managed to recover from that was just incredible. Incredible.
Yeah, I had assumed he retired. And he's 37 and he's still playing in Qatar. And the Qatar League is a pretty decent level. The players move from there to Europe and it's a pretty high level. So he's playing at a very competitive high level.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Can I ask how much work and effort is put in behind the scenes into the players' mental health? Obviously, there's injuries. You've got medical staff on board. But is there has there been a shift in thinking there?
Yeah.
And obviously, I mean, we touched on nutrition kind of joking, but Saif and I are, in agreement when it comes to the nutrition side of things. It's, well, read the Fiat standard, Fiat food and everything else. What's going on there? How's that?
It's changed so much since I was first, I mean, since I made my debut. Whenever it was 15 years ago, it's crazy to see how much it's changed, like the mental side of the game. There's psychologists, probably a couple in every team, I would say now in the Prem. There was none of that. There was none of that back in when I first started. It was kind of, we were in the era of like the macho, you're not a human, you're a robot and you need to go and play and win every game and perform at a high level. So it's changed a lot and it's great to see because it's definitely needed. It's definitely needed clearly with some of the cases that we've seen over the years with players and not just players, but people from all backgrounds. But it's definitely increased over the last few years.
I just actually checked, and no, in fact, I did get that wrong. You did actually play in the 5-1 at Anfield when Liverpool won. You played for 29 minutes. I'm just checking now on Transfer Market. You didn't start, but you played.
Ah, yeah. Wow.
You conveniently forgot that.
Yeah. I might have to just look at my start record there then, not my...
And to be fair, by the time you came on, it was already 5-0 or 4-0 or something like that. Right. So you couldn't have done it.
I'd like to keep all of only the good memories at Anfield, to be honest. But thanks for reminding me.
Sorry for ruining that. I'll never get over that 4-4 with Arshavin. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Crazy.
All right. Well, listen, Kira, this has been incredible. I really thank you so much for your time. This has been incredibly generous and incredibly informative. If I came off as a little teenage fanboy, that's only because I am. I've still not outgrown that phase of my life.
You have to keep it. That's what it's all about. I've
heard Daniel make this case that, you know, you just got to outgrow it. And I don't know. It just doesn't work for me. The game just gets more interesting, more compelling, more engrossing as I grow older. And it just has so many more facets that you keep learning about, you know, the psychology of it, the finances of it, the money, when it becomes so big. It's just it's always interesting. I can't get over it. So today Liverpool will play against Man United.
You need to get prepared. You've got an hour.
Yes, I need to start warming up.
be a great game.
Yeah,
especially where they're both at, how they both started.
Yeah, no, we gotta get our act together very quick if we need to salvage this season.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us. This has been incredibly fun. Thank you so much.
No, honestly, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I'm sure we'll speak. We've got a few things to speak about. Safe, you know. My academy, and
absolutely
we'll start a little seminar with the players. We'll get a group Zoom, and nice. we'll get things going. We need to get these guys orange pilled.
Absolutely, and I'm happy to do it anytime. Thank you so much again,
guys. Thank you very much.
Cheers, man. Thanks.
Take care.